This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I know a lot of you have suspected this for a long time, but here's a book that argues judges are politicians wearing robes. It's called The Judge. It is co-authored by David Scover and Ronald Collins. David is a law professor at Seattle U, and Ron teaches at UW. And we have David with us this morning. You wrote this, you sort of patterned this after Machiavelli's The Prince. But here's what I got from it. You don't care what judges purport to be. You're trying to document what they are. And what they are people who basically construct an opinion that they want and then sort of put it in constitutional citing to make the rest of the world listen to them, right?
I think you've caught a good deal of what we're trying to say. I think the key word to understanding our book is the very first word in our prologue, and that is hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. What connects our book, The Judge, to Machiavelli's book, The Prince, is this theme of hypocrisy. It's entirely central to both books. No one admits it, but many practice it. Hypocrisy thrives in the most principled of contexts, the judges claim to be following precedent. They claim to be following the rule of law as set down in a principled manner. And yet they operate in a hypocritical fashion. If we were to condemn hypocrisy, however, we'd have to write out a good one half of appellate decision making in this country. It infuses the court's business through and through.
But what really I think will impress people is that even judges who purport to be these strict constructionists, which everybody wants now, are as bad as the so-called liberal activists. They're making it up. And I've only read, I mean, I'm obviously not a lawyer. I've read maybe a handful of court opinions. And I think just about every one, I find myself saying, this guy's made up his mind. He's just now searching for some constitutional clothing for this, and it could have gone either way. And I'd like you, because there's a lot we could talk about, but I want to focus on one thing I think everybody can identify with, is the Heller decision, which gave everyone in America the individual right to own a gun. And you point out that Justice Scalia, who wrote that opinion, pretty much fabricated the argument, even though he purported to be following the Second Amendment. Can give us a little outline of that, would you?
Certainly, I certainly will. Yes, Judge Scalia changed the law of the Second Amendment in Heller, as you note, and he paid lip service to all of his favorite conservative judicial approaches. He paid lip service to textualism. He paid lip service to historical intent, framers' intent. He paid lip service to the rule of law in doctrine, and yet he engaged in interpretive cleverness with respect to all of them. The Heller opinion is a wondrous example of a conservative use of this hypocritical technique that we're talking about is common to all judges. So let me just talk about textualism, for example. He segregated the clauses of the Second Amendment. He called the militia clause, which starts the Second Amendment, he called it's the prefatory clause. But the clause to bear arms, he considered to be the operative clause. Already he has told you what he has favored.
And right? That comes out of nowhere, right?
And that comes out of nowhere.
Because it begins a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The framers put that first, and they didn't have to say that. They used the words well-regulated militia, which sounds like a trained organization, but Scalia chose to ignore that.
Well, he doesn't ignore it. This is his interpretive moment, right? Mm-hmm. The liberals in dissent are saying, well, that well-regulated militia language was meant to limit the use of guns in America. Of the right to bear arms. He says, oh no, the operative, the important clause is the individual right to bear arms. This militia clause is just an example, one example of where arms can be used in America. So he artfully reorganizes the meaning of the text in his interpretive moment, right? Now, one might say, well, the text allows you this latitude of motion. But the point, right, is that judges from both sides of the fence, looking at the same words, come up with two totally different textual meanings. That essentially, you know, signifies that text doesn't drive a decision. It's the judge's choice. And the more you see Scalia sort of twisting the doctrine, the text, the history. And when it comes to history, he cherry picks history. He finds a few examples of historical moments that he can say supports the idea that everybody understood this was an individual right to that could not be limited by some collective purpose like a well-regulated militia. When he looks at doctrine, all of the case precedent ran against him. This was case precedent dealing with regulating guns, gun control, really during the 1910s and 20s. And he basically dismisses this precedent, distinguishes it, saying, well, these were about sawed-off shotguns. I mean, without really looking at the principle that that was established, which was that the well-regulated militia clause was a limitation on the individual right to own a gun. So the bottom line is, in every one of his favorite approaches for interpreting the Constitution, Scalia does artful interpretive work. And some of us would say, well, given the dedication he has to these approaches, this seems hypocritical.
Give me an example of where the liberals did the same thing.
Oh, well, my favorite example has to be William O. Douglas in Griswold. In Griswold, William O. Douglas created, out of whole cloth, the right of privacy. And he gave rise to constitutional legitimacy for the sexual revolution. Just consider where the right of privacy has gone since the Griswold decision, which had to do with the right to contraception use in marriage. It's gone far beyond that to abortion, and now it's gone to same-sex marriage. So the right of privacy has become a crucible in which many sexual rights have been
invalidated.
And
that, too, just made up.
Well, what does Douglas do? What is his artful hypocrisy? He says, oh, look, there are privacy emanations coming from these amendments. And he dances through the third, fourth, fifth, seventh amendments and says, well, there are privacy penumbras, he calls them, or emanations coming from these amendments. Well, when he looks to the right of contraception, he doesn't attach it to any one of the amendments. What he does is stitch all of these emanations together and say, and so this means that the Constitution protects a general right of privacy. So he has created, out of whole cloth, really, a right of privacy, now detached from all the amendments and operating on its own. And thus he can throw the right to contraception into it. And in the future, Justice Kennedy can throw the right to same-sex marriage into it.
Of course, in the privacy case, the internet's taken care of that. That's gone no matter what the Supreme Court says. But what this adds up to is that Donald Trump's supporters were right when they said, all we care about is that he appointed Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, because that's the most important thing he could possibly do. And you seem to be saying that's exactly right. If you're a conservative, it's really annoying to try and pack Congress with conservatives because there's too much left to chance there. Elections could go either way. But if you can get a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, you've won, because it is a 9-member political body.
Well, you do have to remember that the Supreme Court of the United States takes very few cases every year.
But the most important ones.
And yes, it does. It has the most hot button issues. So when it comes to hot button social issues, the U.S. Supreme Court, if it chooses to review the case, you know, will be able to pronounce, and that will become quote unquote supreme law, because as justice, as Chief Justice John Marshall is doing the most Machiavellian work of any justice on the court, declared, we have constitutional review power. And later, the court says in Cooper versus Aaron, and our constitutional review power is supreme. So the most Machiavellian jurist is unquestionably John Marshall, the great Chief Justice, and everyone of any stripe, whether conservative or liberal on the court, will bow to Chief Justice John Marshall as the greatest Chief Justice. And as we say in the book, that he was, because he was the greatest Machiavellian.
Right. Who was able, by interfering in a case which he should have recused himself from, to write a few words on paper and give the court an immense amount of power that remains to this day.
Machiavelli would have smiled broadly when he read the case you're referring to, Marbury versus Madison. This is the case where John Marshall refuses to recuse himself, even though, as Secretary of State, he signed.
Right.
So Marbury's commission.
He had been Secretary of State and then became Chief Justice, ruling on something that he had been involved personally in as Secretary of State.
That's correct. He had signed William Marbury's commission. His brother was supposed to deliver the commission, but failed to do so by midnight.
And this was a judicial appointment.
This is a judicial appointment, right. And then Marbury sues, saying, I want the seat that was supposed to be given to me as D.C. D.C. Judge, Justice of the Peace. I want that seat. I was supposed to get my commission. It's just that Marshall's brother failed to deliver it on time. John Marshall is sitting in judgment on the case, and he doesn't recuse himself. Not only does he not recuse himself, but then he uses this case to achieve a masterful strike. At one and the same time, he tells the President of the United States that the President is subject to Supreme Court jurisdiction and must follow Supreme Court law. He strikes a law of Congress using this new constitutional review power that he establishes in the case, and he throws Marbury under the bus and says, you know, you had a right to your commission. There is a remedy in law, but you came to the wrong court. So we don't have jurisdiction. This is a masterful Machiavellian ploy, right?
Which would explain why it wasn't overturned, because the new administration didn't want him to become a judge.
The new administration tried to impeach Marshall, but they just didn't have teeth, because Marshall had not required President Jefferson or James Madison, his Secretary of State, to do anything. So there was no order against them. That was part of the masterful stroke. Why Machiavelli would have been proud is he followed the prince in three ways. He increased the glory and the power of his political institution, the court. He enhanced his own glory. I mean, he is now the greatest Chief Justice of the United States. And he managed to control what Machiavelli called fortuna, or chance. He mastered chance, and he managed to pull this all off without any risk to himself or to his institution, by saying, I cannot order the president to do anything. Now, this is Machiavelli, you know, par exemple. And I truly believe that Machiavelli would have, as I said earlier, smiled very broadly and praised John Marshall.
Now, I can't figure out in what I've read of the book whether you think this is good or bad, because as you point out, the first word in the book is hypocrisy, and that usually has a negative connotation, but you are obviously in admiration of the way some of these jurists have pulled off this hypocrisy, and you also further point out that the system has always operated this way, and in fact, must operate this way because the founders are long dead, and you pretty much have to pretend you're following the Constitution because you can't pretend you're following their wishes because they're not around to tell you whether you are or not.
You know, I expect to receive this question on every interview I do on this book. I truly believe that everyone will ask me at some point, as you did, well, what do you feel? Is this what you're really endorsing? And my response, and it is the response we give our readers, is that what we think is right is irrelevant. What Machiavelli said to the prince that he was writing to, he was writing to Lorenzo de' Medici, the new prince who had come in 1512 to rule Florence when Florence was a city-state. He said to him, I will tell you what the world is, not what it ought to be. And we have taken Machiavelli seriously here. We wrote in that Machiavellian spirit. So I say to you and all my readers, I will tell you what the judge is, what the Machiavellian judge is, not how the court ought to be. At no point do we either endorse or condemn what's going on from our perspective. The only perspective we ever hold out is Machiavelli's, and Machiavelli would be proud of Justice Scalia in Heller, of Justice Douglas in Griswold, and of Chief Justice Marshall in Marbury.
David Scover is the co-author of The Judge. He and his co-author, Ron Collins, are going to be at Elliott Bay Books Saturday, 7 p.m., and they're going to be interviewed by a Supreme Court Justice, Mary Yu of the Washington State Supreme Court. And that should be a pretty interesting evening, especially since you're going to ask her to – are you going to ask her to admit when she has practiced hypocrisy in her own decisions?
No, we aren't intending to do that, but if she ever did – admit to hypocrisy, she would not be a good Machiavellian judge.
That's true. The key to carrying off hypocrisy is to pretend you're not.
That's correct.
That's right. Thank you, David.
It was very pleasant to be with you. Thank you.